Welcome to Bare Naked Money, the podcast where we strip down the complex world of finance to its bare essentials with your hosts, Josh Shellick and Colin White, portfolio managers with Varakin Capital Management, Inc.
Welcome to the next episode of Bare Naked Money. It's Colin here with Matt Kempton, who's joined us today as a special guest to have a conversation about talking about money. So Matt is going to perform Josh's role and keep us on track and walk us through all the various aspects of talking about money. Welcome, Matt. Where did you want to start the conversation?
Well, I thought we might focus on a couple key areas today for our conversations around money. And one of the big ones I think we should start with is speaking to your kids about your estate plan. I mean, as we know, and CPA Canada gave some numbers around this, there's a very, very large generational transfer of wealth coming up here. In fact, the biggest ever in Canadian history, with over the next few years, a combined expected about $1 trillion to change hands. So a lot of money is about to change hands as this current generation sort of moves on. So with that, hopefully a lot of conversations happening. However, we know from the stats that this isn't necessarily the case. And so I just have a, like Josh would, I've gone in and looked at some surveys, look at some data here, and maybe a little dated here, but I imagine it's still quite correct here. A 2018 Wells Fargo study showed that the majority of aging parents have not talked to their kids about their end-of-life needs and haven't done so because they don't feel any urgency. And this would even be true of respondents in their 80s. And then a similar study in 2018 showed that the 9 out of 10 adult children who have had these discussions only had them because a life-altering event had occurred. So they aren't just happening naturally. They're happening because some urgency gets put behind it, which isn't maybe the best scenario to be in to have a calm, thoughtful, rational discussion. It creates just a, let's put something in place because, well, we absolutely have to. But then interestingly, those that had a conversation, those that actually, the minority who have felt at ease and felt the process was actually quite straightforward after they went through that. So, it might be hard to talk about money, and there's a lot of reasons around that why that might be true. But once people, once you do so, you might feel better about it. So, Colin, you've got a number of decades of experience having these, being in the room for these type of discussions and probably encouraging these type of discussions. What has been your experience with the reluctance that might be there, and then going through the process, and then the after effects of having actually had the conversations?
Well, I mean, families are complicated things, and honestly, it's one of the things that attracted me to this line of work, because it's something you'll never get a complete handle on. I mean, let's be honest, many people would rather talk about politics or the color of pus that's coming out of the sore on their arm that they don't know what it is. They would rather have a conversation like that than talk about money. And so it's just one of those taboo conversations. It's got a lot wrapped up in it. There's a lot of emotion around it. And I think regardless of what's at stake, the emotional side of this is what drives the bus. There are people with very little or very modest estates who have had a very thorough conversation and everything is nicely lined up. And you're right, for those people, that's a huge sense of comfort. But most families have, the family dynamics are tied up. And those change over time too. Like, you can have a good conversation at one moment in time, but then things happen and, you maybe aren't talking about it. But the stakes are quite high to do it right. There can be huge savings on the tax side. There can be a huge emotional advantage to talking things out so that there's, not surprises down the road or missed expectations. But it's, you kind of frame this as, say, parents talking to kids, but this is also kids talking to parents. This is a two-way conversation. Either can bring it up. And, for me, the onus is more on the children talking to their parents, because if the parents don't do something, then the burden is going to drop squarely in the lap of the kids. So they're the ones with the vested interest to have some kind of a plan. So, and sometimes for them, once they've been the executor of one estate, they don't ever want to be an executor again, right? So, and part of that is how messed up the process can be. So planning can go a tremendously long way, but just because it's practical and rational and reasonable doesn't make it any easier, doesn't make it any more likely to happen, because all the emotions can get in the way. I have people crying in my office most regularly over family and money. Like that's the most reason, the most obvious reason for tears to be shed in an office, because that's how emotionally fraught that it is. So it's, you know, regardless of how important it is, it's going to remain something that's difficult to talk about. One of the things I would offer is sometimes having a moderator in the form of a seasoned professional just to moderate the conversation. Because, you know, the vast majority of times when I'm sitting in a room having a conversation like that, they get to a point in the conversation they had never gotten to before, because they had preconceived notions and lack of true perspective. That a little bit of perspective can go a long way. You know, there could be an insurmountable problem that's very mountable. It could be something that's actually very simple to deal with, but it's been built into a big boogeyman that really isn't an issue. And there's many, many examples of that kind of thing. So, you know, having a moderated conversation with a good advisor who will take the time to help you have that conversation can be really valuable and important. But you have to overcome all the ickiness of talking about money, because there's a real downside to it too. Like, you can really screw it up. You can cause a lot of family stress over talking about money. It can cause problems while you're alive. And some people will just make the decision, I'd rather that problem happen when I'm dead, so I'm not going to talk about money. Therefore, I've planned. Thank you.
Well, you're right. I mean, I suppose in a worst case scenario, you do hear the nightmare scenarios where, you know, parents maybe start to use their estate distributions as a weapon, or how much do you love me? Come visit me. If not, well, you might be cut out of the will. And so, you know, maybe worst case scenario, it gets taken to that point.
That never happens, Matt. You don't love me anymore, therefore you're out of the will. You know, I think that's a very important point to make. Sometimes this can be weaponized, and this can cause damage if not properly considered. And there's many different ways it can cause damage. Sometimes it's issues nothing to do with money that get transferred into the money arena. Like you said, you don't love me, therefore I'm not giving you money. Sometimes that is the case. And other times it's, you know, just changing priorities over time. Like, you know, something you said to somebody when you're talking to your children about money, then they have grandkids. Okay, well, now this is a different ballpark. You know, so it's like there's a lot of upside to having a good open conversation about it. But the reason it doesn't happen is that there's danger in having that open conversation. It can cause resentment that can affect the family. So it's not a mystery. Like, this isn't like, oh, I can't believe people aren't doing this. It's so obvious they should be doing this. No, it is legitimately scary for good reason, which is, again, finding good counsel. Like, you know, whether you find that with your accountant, your lawyer, your financial advisor, you know, somebody who's a professional who can sit in the room and moderate a conversation and help you keep it on track.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as you're getting at here, I mean, one of the hardest things, you're talking about money, that's already hard to do, but you're effectively talking about death. And that's very, very hard for people to do. And so you've added in two very hard areas of discussion and sort of lumped them together as part of this. And so that's a hard wall to even get over for some, and emotional all the way around.
Well, yeah. And you also have the situation where maybe the older generation is trying to exert a control, or trying to reach back from the grave and make sure that their money is used for priorities that they think are important. And, you know, a little bit of that is reasonable, but after a certain point, it just becomes untenable. You know, at the end of the day, once you're dead, you're dead. And, you know, your legacy is going to be decided by those who are still here. And to try to put a whole lot of controls or expectations on how that money is allocated, one of two things: either you're going to set up more animosity within the family over, you know, doing things of that nature, or two, you're going to create a legal and accounting nightmare that's going to actually drain money out of your estate and actually make it way less effective at accomplishing any goals. So, you know, it's really I encourage people to, you know, when they're making their plans, to trust the next generation, because at the end of the day, they're going to make the decisions. And they may or may not make them the way you think that they should be made, but, you know, that's going to be they get to write their own movie. They get to decide their priorities. They get to decide what they're going to do with their situation. And expecting that you can put enough strings attached, like, this money is only to be used for education of the grandkids and that pot grows to $5 million and none of the grandkids want to go to university. Now what do you do? You've created a problem that's going to have to be addressed one way or another. That's an exaggeration to make a point, but that is something that you see where they try to set up and it's like, okay, not only existing grandkids, but all future grandkids. Just stop. I mean, like you're now envisioning, you know, the birth of more humans after your death, and you want to have a say in how money gets spent to support them. At a certain point, you just, in my opinion, stop it. don't make it more complicated. Trust that you've raised the next generation. You've given them the right set of moral compasses that they need to make good decisions for themselves in the moment. Because you know, no idea what the situation they're going to be facing down the road.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, when you start planning for people you've never even met before, you're probably taking it too far. I mean, the idea of generational wealth, is appealing to some, but that's effectively what you're doing is saying, well, let me plan for all of these individuals who I've never met, but I think I know what's best for them.
Yeah. The arrogance. Unmitigated arrogance to behave that way. And I have very frank conversations with people over their expectations, because I think it's very, very important to take a good hard look at, you know, what your expectations are. Because putting restrictions on something imagines that you can understand all the variables that are going to be there in the future. And that's just not knowable. I mean, you know, you take a look at the advances and the hiccups that have been seen on a global scale that have dramatically altered, you know, financial realities for people. It happens on the regular. Giving the next generation your trust and confidence that they're going to deal with that in the best way possible is 9 times out of 10 the best way to go. Now, I'll contradict myself. Do you want me to contradict myself?
Please do.
There's nothing more damaging to somebody than sudden wealth. You know, all of the studies about people who won a lottery and how quickly they go bankrupt and, you know, things of that nature. So there are some real concerns that people have about, you know, the next generation kind of thing. And some of it may be something you can work around or you can improve, but sometimes that's just the reality. Sudden wealth really can do and does do and statistically does do, and studies have shown that it does. It really destroys or can destroy or negatively affect somebody's economic outcome. So, you know, I'm arguing against myself now, but having an eye to that. Now, the way to deal with that maybe is not putting restrictions in your will to try to protect against that. It may be working with that generation to help them gain the money skills that they need while you're still around, so that you give them a better chance of behaving properly. But it's tough. It's absolutely tough. And I mean, I get tasked from time to time. It's like, you need to talk to my 16-year-old about setting up an RSP. Really? I'm pretty sure that the 16-year-old is not thinking about RSPs. I'm not that talented. I'm not going to be able to give them the gift of wanting to invest, you know, at that age.
Well, you didn't know me at 16 then, I guess.
Yeah. But I wasn't going to walk in the room and convince you of shit. Like at that age, you know, most 16-year-olds are not thinking about savings. They're thinking about the other sex and they're thinking about cars, right? Or whatever. So sometimes the expectations of parents and how quickly, and frankly, what the next generation needs to learn. And that too is a bit arrogant, because, you know, you may have done well for yourself, but you may or may not have, you know, the proper perspective to pass that on to the next generation. But that's more of an issue you can deal with while you're alive. And it's a cautionary tale, but at the end of the day, if somebody's going to be bad with money, they're going to be bad with money.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair contradiction, really, because it's hard. But that's why the conversations are very important to have, and I think they create a better chance of success. But that sudden wealth item is very hard. I mean, a big part of, I think, what advisors are here to do and can help in doing is preparing the next generation for wealth, showing them, you know, getting them accustomed to how to work with a wealth advisor, how to build a plan for themselves, and maybe forecasting, well, an inheritance might come in at some point. You might be able to use it for buying that home, paying off a mortgage, or these purposes, and putting a plan around it versus, you know, $1 million drops in a bank account and they say, I'm off to Vegas or who knows. And you've seen it. I'm sure I've seen the very damaging things that can come from that sudden wealth. So, but you hope to create more of a chance of success by having those conversations earlier, because the lottery ticket win can do a lot of damage.
Yeah. And it's a matter of trying to increase the odds of a good outcome. Right.
Yeah.
So, when you're having a conversation between generations about money, it's high risk. I won't lie. I don't want this podcast message to be everybody should talk to their family immediately about money without giving it some serious thought, because it can be damaging and you shouldn't minimize that. But there's ways that you can go about it that are higher potential for a positive outcome. If you can set up a moderated conversation, that's great. Having a professional in the room to guide a conversation and help you, talk about, and having a conversation with that professional in advance of that meeting. It's funny. I've had conversations where I'm talking with the parents. They're going, okay, we really have to keep this family property in the family. It's the most important thing to us. It's been in the family for generations. And I have a relationship with the kids, and the kids are going, oh, fuck no. No, I'm never going to go back there. I live in BC.
I don't live here. Yeah.
I'm not going to travel back to that. Christ, no.
I've never met my cousins. I don't want to be part of it.
Right. So I'm sitting between those two groups going, wow, they never have talked, have they? And like the parents are twisting themselves into a knot, and like their whole life is around accomplishing this goal. And I really, it's maybe not my place. I don't have the heart to tell them. It's like, it's really not that important. Right. But they would have to consent to, all right, let's have a family conversation about money, and I can offer, but it's going to be up to them to take. But that's an illustration of the advantage of it. Because again, there can be a misunderstanding between generations that, mom and dad have these priorities and the kids have different priorities. And maybe when they get together, it gets way simpler than anybody thought. Maybe it gets way simpler. So it's a fraught conversation for sure. But the other point I'd like to make is that one of the dangers of the next generation is if they know, and this is again, one of the dangers of talking about money, if all of a sudden they get a figure in their heads, like, well, I'm going to get inheritance from mom and dad, and that's my retirement plan. So I don't need to do anything else.
Yep.
That's dangerous.
True.
That's a very, very dangerous. So that absolves yourself of the responsibility of making sound financial decisions on your own. That opens you up to the idea that maybe you're wrong and that money gets spent on end of life care for your parents and you never do see the money. Now you're in a pickle. You got no money, no skills, and no time because you've waited for this for so long. So again, it's another one of the trap doors you can fall through in having these conversations and a negative outcome that some people avoid. I mean, I do have parents that say, my kids don't think they're getting anything and I'm not talking to them about it because I don't want them to behave as if this is coming. That's their strategy.
Well, that's true. I think that one has a lot of risk too. But then sort of the counter I've seen to that is parents don't share. Kids worked their whole lives to whatever stake, maybe struggled a ways for a number of years, and then, enter, say, their 60s, and then have this windfall that at that point they didn't know was coming, and it helps them, but they didn't necessarily need it at that point. They needed it earlier, but had no idea that that level of wealth existed because it was never discussed. And hurt feelings can happen there too, to say, well, I could have done trips with our family. And
a grasshopper, the older guy looking back going, that struggle is what you needed to go through in order to be where you are, right?
Yeah.
To think that money is going to buy people that are going through struggle and that's good, history would disagree. There's the old saying, hard men make easy times make weak men make hard times. Like I watched it happen. Like you've got one generation that is super successful financially and the next generation pisses it all into the wind, right? It's a different mindset if you have a scarcity and you're an accumulator and all the rest of it. That is a mindset for sure, and part of that is born out of scarcity. Mm-hmm. So the next generation comes along and doesn't have that. That is more likely they're going to accumulate way less or diminish what's there. And again, that's a very, very repeatable cycle that happens.
Short sleeves to short sleeves in three generations, that just happens. It's just how it goes. Yeah.
But I mean, and this is why, to go back to earlier, the way you kind of set this up, which is, a very typical way of setting it up. You had this huge wealth transfer happening. Nobody's talking about it. That's bad. You should talk about it. there's a whole lot of reasons people aren't talking about it, because talking about it doesn't always make it better, right? Sometimes it's just going to go for a shit. Like, no matter how much you talk about it, this just isn't fixable. So it's all about increasing the likelihood of having the best possible outcome. And both of those are constrained. Like, you're never going to get an ideal outcome. Like, if you give $5 million to somebody and say, there, you're going to be happy, science isn't on your side. That's just not how happy is, right? You can remove some of the strain on shelter and food and lifestyle, but those aren't all of the ingredients of being happy and content. You haven't fixed anything. So again, I think that's why this is a fraught conversation. I don't mean to be too demoralizing. Am I being too demoralizing?
No, not at all. I mean, again, it's so complicated. And a good outcome is different in all cases. You know, a good outcome might be, you know, families coming to the conclusion that, or maybe the heirs coming, or rather the parents coming to the conclusion, we will start some gifting earlier. We've got the ability to do so. And you can see a need on your end, and we'd like to, and you know, maybe it's just a portion of it over time to share with you. And that feeling of the next generation feeling, that's very fair. We're so appreciative of that. And that's a good outcome. Or maybe the outcome is we're going to retain everything. It'll all come your way eventually, but we need to make sure that we are secure in our lifetime. And maybe the next generation is okay with that. And that's a good outcome. Or maybe the next generation doesn't like either one of those outcome decisions by the parents. And so it's a bad outcome decided by some or by one party. You know, it's a consensus is not guaranteed. And again, as an emotional item, but I still think the conversations are worth having, though they can be challenging.
Well, but you have the optimism of youth. You know, we can talk about this and make it better. And that's how you should get out of bed in the morning. You should be optimistic. You know, so, and either scenario you described can be the absolute best scenario or the absolute worst, right? Because, you know, gifting along the way, in the right situation, done the right way, with the right people, is very appreciated and doesn't really diminish their ability to function on their own. Other times, all of a sudden, it becomes a crutch, and the person loses the ability to make, you know, truly sustainable financial decisions for themselves because they consciously or subconsciously are expecting the next, you know, bit of money to show up. You know, so all of the different ways that we've talked about approaching this can work out and can also not work out because, you know, again, another one of the old expressions, you can commit no errors and still lose. Like, you can do everything that's right that you possibly can and still have an outcome that you're not happy with.
Yeah. Maybe to that outcome, when we talked about the inheritor who views it as, you know, a lottery ticket or a big win and then, you know, goes on a free fall of spending, there's another profile that exists, a challenge one, and that's the inheritor's guilt profile, where they inherit and feel, that's not my money, I can't touch it. Or maybe I can only touch income, I could never touch the capital, that's dad's, that's mom's, that's theirs. Yeah. And that's not necessarily a healthy one either. Now, what's the money for? And was that their intention, that you would never benefit truly from it? And now where does it go from there? And do you pass that same guilt on to the next generation so that they can go the other extreme, where I say, I just can't touch it, it's not mine. And I'll live well below my means despite having this now.
Well, money is stress. And there's going to be people who listen to this who are going to giggle. But it is, because I see it every day. Like, if enough money comes in every month for me to feed myself and clothe myself and put a roof over my head, and that's it, I don't have to make any decisions, that's pretty free. Now, in that life, you're going to find something to worry about, whether it's politics or climate change or, you know, some conspiracy theory. You're going to find something to worry about. But you give that same person, you know, $5 million and they're faced with all these decisions, that could be equally stressful, because now it's like, oh, well, what do I owe my siblings? What do I owe my nieces and nephews? What do I owe my kids? How can I be fair with this? And there's no easy answer to those questions. All of those questions are hugely open-ended questions. And so with the right kind of person, that is tremendously anxiety provoking and can be very debilitating, honestly. So again, it's, I feel I'm negative today. I don't know what it is, whether I'm in a bad mood, but, I guess I've dealing with a lot of estates right now. So there's a lot of examples kind of whirling around in my head, of the challenges of exactly this kind of conversation.
Yeah. But so on that estate end, I think it's important, and you would have seen much of this. I mean, you know, in the role, you have planning conversations, but then you see the estate distribution. And so you see the actual way it plays out. And in terms of, well, how is it received by the heirs? Who's involved? The executors. How did that piece of it go? We haven't touched much on, well, who's actually going to carry this plan out? Are they capable of doing so? Did they know they were in the role? Are they interested in being in the role? But that, and did you set it up in such a way that it's going to, what you thought was going to occur will? In that, did you, the way you wrote the document, is the carrying out of that going to follow what you thought were your intentions, or are you going to have unintended consequences based on who you set up or the restrictions you might have applied or whatever it might be? So that part of it, it's just interesting occasionally how there's a gap between what you think is written down, what you think is going to occur, and then ultimately what does, just for whether it's bank policies or all sorts of different reasons, the ultimate execution of it can be challenging and different than you expected.
I'll go on record right now to say, if you've named somebody as the executor, if you will, and you haven't told them, you don't like that person very much. That is perhaps the meanest thing you could ever do to somebody that you're putting that kind of responsibility on, because sweet love of God, the responsibility taken on by an executor and the burden that is on them and the legal responsibility that they take on is monumental. And if you superimpose over top of that, you expect them to execute on your wishes while they're keeping everybody happy. It becomes very quickly a full-time job. And I've only met one person in my entire life who was an executor who said they would do it again. Every other executor I've talked to said, oh God, no, never again. I would recuse myself if I ever got named again, because it is a burden. So, you know, in talking about having conversations about money, talk to your executor. Never, ever, ever, ever let that be something people find out about after you're gone. And I'll go further and recommend that having one executor is way better than having five, you know, because again, if you need five people to sign off in every document, that's monumental. You know, you find one person who's a good administrator. It's not an honor to be named as an executor. Like it's like, hey, congratulations, you get to be the executor. It's like, oh my God, that's amazing. No, this is like, would you mind doing this for me? It's going to be a lot of work. Could you do this for me? You know, that's what you're doing. But people feels like, oh, I need to put both my kids on there. I need to put all three of my kids on there. No, you don't. In fact, they're going to not like you very much for having done that. That's because it's going to dramatically complicate things for them.
I mean, all good points. And I mean, to the point around the honor of being named an executor, I think that's maybe a way of thinking of years past, that I'll name our most capable child as the executor, and what an honor to do so, when really it's a burden. You've just created a burden to this person. And then, but the alternative, name everybody. Well, now you've created a real problem. How often are all these people in the same room at the same time, at this emotional time, especially, are they all going to be able to agree on anything? And have you just really challenged the execution and of this estate and the deliverance of it? Because it,
if you've got a very super capable child who lives in Calgary, and you know they maybe have got the most skill to deal with it, and you live in Halifax, and you've got another child who lives in Halifax who is not as skilled but is super capable, well, you probably would just name the person in Halifax, you know, from a practical perspective. Like if they're capable of doing it, maybe. But again, it's not a judgment call between the siblings that this is more capable than the other, because you're right, that's what it gets into. That's where the emotional, the lizard brain kind of kicks in. It's like, why didn't I get picked to be the executor? I thought mom always loved him more, right? You know, that kind of response kicks in.
Yeah.
We haven't even touched on the other biggest mistake people make.
Okay. What did we miss?
Oh, well, have you got to the end of your list?
So are we heading on to the next area of conversation?
No. I'm still.
Oh, you still have more to go. All right. What did we miss here?
The role of tax planning in your estate.
Of course.
Right? Because, you know, that's what happens when you're dealing with a very messy conversation and there's some questions you can't answer. There's things that you just can't come to a determination on. You will default back to something that you can make a decision on. Better yet, something you can calculate. So instead of turning it into, you know, the smoothest estate transition you can find, you turn it into, I need to tax optimize this. Why? Because all the other questions are too tough for me to deal with. So I need to feel like I'm doing something. So I'm going to tax optimize this. And then you start going down the road of twisting yourself into a pretzel, trying to minimize taxes in the estate. And many, many of the actions taken in the name of tax simplification or probate avoidance can be hugely complicating in actually adjudicating an estate. Sometimes when you're alive, because some people will change ownerships on assets while they're still alive with the goal of circumnavigating some of the probate and their tax consequences. Number one, they're not very effective. Number two, they tend to be hugely complicating in unintentional ways. And it's a default for people to say, I can't make any of these hard decisions, but I need to plan my estate. Therefore, I'm going to have a really tight tax plan and then pat myself on the back and say, I have an estate plan. And It's not really being honest. It's just transference, I think psychologists would call it.
Well, that's a really good point. And this is one that I find experiences to me has been so helpful in this one, because you might think about an estate and that, you know, that feels like one of the top things you should consider. Let me just minimize probate, especially here in Nova Scotia. But the ways that people go about it often, again, have unintended consequences. So let's look at a few key examples of way people might do it. So let's say, you know, somewhat common estate of tax-free savings account, couple RIF accounts, maybe a smaller joint investment account. Well, let's set up the beneficiaries immediately and a life insurance policy, or maybe multiple. Let's set up the beneficiaries immediately to all of the children, all of the heirs. Monies will go directly to them quickly, and there'll be a smaller estate, less probate to deal with. But what about, of course, the tax bill that's going to get generated from the triggering of those RIFs? Now, how does that bill get paid? Where are the funds to pay that? The executor, now you've put in a position to say, I might have to claw back funds from the heirs to cover this tax bill or be personally liable to the CRA for this. And so the well-intentioned piece of let me avoid probate, let me just get the money right to my heirs and do so quickly has created an unintended but very real consequence of no funds available. And this also happens in areas where, you know, maybe there's real estate involved, it's not liquid, it's meant to stick around. Oh, tax bill triggered. How do you fund this? And that, I've seen that go poorly, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, you know, and CRA will go after a beneficiary of a registered account if the estate is unable to pay the tax bill. So the money goes to a beneficiary. The beneficiary spends the money based on their mortgage to buy a property. The money's gone. The CRA shows up 3 months later and says, yeah, you owe us $120,000. They're going, what? You can't do that. Like, well, we can. And we just did. You know, so that's one way it goes wrong. We've had a situation where a client put one of their children on title to a property. It was a recreational or an investment property. They had a falling out. So she goes, okay, I want to take them off the property now. It's like, that's not the way that works. That's, you know, but it's, again, all in an effort to chase this elusive, I need to avoid probate. People, get over yourself. Probate's not that big a deal. And the unintended consequences and potential costs and screw-ups of taking dramatic steps like changing ownership of assets and leaving a bankrupt estate are going to cause way more fees and complications for the heirs than you could ever possibly avoid.
Go. Well, and just on that piece of, the falling out scenario, but they're both on title. Oh, and now you've created a trust filing requirement based on the new CRA rules. It's only become ever complicated.
That's just it. And people don't understand, the more complicated you make it, the more complicated it is and the more fragile it is, right? The more fragile it becomes, right? So and I fault the professional community for that in many regards, because it's very compelling to walk into somebody that's a prospect or client to show how smart you are. And it's like, oh, you're paying way too much probate. I can have you pay way less probate. I'm going to save you money because I'm a really smart guy. That's compelling. That will earn you a client. That will open up a relationship for you as a professional. And I don't say that it's done consciously necessarily, but that is subconsciously the effect of behaving that way. So there's a self-fulfilling, do you want to save tax? I love saving tax. Well, I want to save you some tax. And nobody pulls back and looks at it from 30,000 feet and say, did this make the whole situation better? Or did it just solve a little problem over here that has ripples and going to cause other problems that are actually bigger? right? It's not looked at from that perspective.
Well, I think you're very right. I think that's a place where we sit at an advantage in, and we can sort of walk through, well, if minimizing taxes is a goal of yours, here we can do so by doing these, but here are the offsets that occur. And being able to show the full sort of the cause and effect that can happen versus simply saying, minimize tax, do this, and this will be your outcome, where we see it all the way through and just know the downsides that can happen when you solely focus on something like that.
Yeah, and this is where the perspective of a qualified advisor comes in, because when I'm sitting listening to somebody plan something, really good chance I've watched somebody else do it, and I've watched the number of ways it can go wrong, and then I've watched some of them come to fruition, right? So real world experience actually has a role there when properly reflected upon, because, you know, something that's good in an academic sense. And the other thing with time, you understand, is that the environment doesn't stay static. Like you bring up trust reporting now, like there's an example. You know, so people took, you know, what seemed to be very reasonable steps for estate planning a number of years ago, but because of regulatory changes now, it's getting less comfortable. And this is the first step of those kind of planning mechanisms becoming less comfortable. So now what do? Have you taken a permanent step that's undoable? Is that the way you would say that? Irreversible.
Yes.
Irreversible is better. Undoable, I don't think is a word. But you know, now you backed yourself into a corner. You thought you were outsmarting the system. You thought you were getting cute. System has a way of smacking people like that in the face every once in a while. So like, part of it's kind of, you know, relax. You can only control so much. There was going to be tax, there's going to be fees, and twisting yourself into a knot with the understanding you're mitigating any of this, you might be fooling yourself. And you've put a lot of effort into something that isn't going to accomplish that goal.
Yeah. No, very, very good point. One area, all of that is important. It all kind of comes out of a good conversation. Another area it feels a little more administrative in nature, but it's pretty key at an emotional time of someone passing is, all right, you've had these conversations. So hopefully now the beneficiaries or the executors, they know who to call. They know where documents are. They know where everything is and how to access it versus, mom's passed away. I don't know who to call. I don't know who she dealt with. I don't know where anything is. I don't even know if there is a will. That's probably worst case scenario, but I think that things like that often happen versus here's an inventory of where everything is. You can find my safety deposit box key here. Please call these people. You've already met them, hopefully, accountant, lawyer, financial advisor. That type of organization, and it all stems out of these conversations, but it just eases everyone at a very challenging time.
I'm disappointed in you, and I'm disappointed in me. We should have led with that, you know, for all the stuff we've been poo-pooing as a waste of time. Get organized and put in your favorite colorful expletive there. Get effing organized. That is a benefit to everybody. Right? So, you know, and that's being basically organized shouldn't cause any ripples. Like, you know, here's some very detailed instructions. Here's a list of accounts, institutions, you know, and keep it relatively up to date and make sure that that's findable. Because if you don't do that, you're a bad person. Like, you are a bad person. If you leave like a treasure hunt behind, yeah, nobody's going to like you. Your whole life is going to be invalidated. Don't be that person.
So what about on the treasure hunt front? And we didn't talk about this much of this. We spent a lot of time talking about money, a little personal property and the China collection and just the years of your school project from the fourth grade and things that can get built up, especially in a family home that's been the family home for decades. And it may be a feeling of the parents to say, I want so-and-so to have this. I know they'd want this, the old grandfather clock that has to go to so-and-so. That piece of it, a lot of them, and that's often more an emotion, maybe even more emotional because the goods might have little monetary value, but one of the beneficiaries might say that painting means everything to me. I have all these memories associated with my childhood and that painting and being in that room, and I need that one. Why didn't mom give that one to me? So that's a complicated area where, you know, it's not even so much a money discussion. It's really just, I have these feelings associated with these items.
Well, for me, that lends a little bit more to pre-gifting, right? Like that lends itself a little bit more to that, because you're not financially putting yourself in a bad spot by doing stuff like that. I will share one funny story that I was aware of, where there was a family that didn't get along very well. So their way of dealing with that particular issue was, there was a family house and the final grandparent was getting close to passing. So they were instructed to go through the house with little sticky notes and put a note on anything that had an interest in. So then it became a game of going around and taking other people's notes off and sticking your note on stuff. So they fought with sticky notes. You know, so you pull something up and like, my sticky note's gone. Why is David's sticky note there? So, you know, again, you're absolutely right. And that is something that's non-monetary. And also something doesn't lend itself to being necessarily enumerated in a will. That's something that could be a codicil or even just a piece of paper that is, you know, stored with the final documents. But also keep in mind, your will doesn't get read for a few days after death. So keep that in mind too. There's a time delay from the time you pass to the time, whatever you put in your will. Yeah. You may already be buried. And then they read.
Well, especially if probate's required, we might be looking at it even further to make sure that's the final.
I'm talking the initial reading of the will, right? So the executor may not even be, like, you know, the funeral may have happened and you've been cremated or planted or whatever is going to happen. Then you read the will, like, whatever you do, don't cremate me. Oh shit. Don't put that in your will. You're going to just disappoint people.
Well, that's a good point. So make sure those wishes are clear and maybe separate.
Well, just keep in your mind that there's going to be a time lag from your passing till they get around to sitting down looking at the will, potentially. Yeah. And that could be a period of days or weeks. So,
yeah. No.
Tales from the edge, man. Also, some of the stuff I've heard and seen.
Yeah.
So have we thoroughly had a conversation about communication, money, estate planning issues with regards to from a communications perspective? Have we beaten all of the pulp out of this?
We've hit on some key items. We've dived in to an extent. I mean, this could be, frankly, I think this could be a 5-hour discussion. I mean, there's so much to it. There's so many scenarios you've seen, scenarios I've been through, and just unique pictures. But we've done a good job, I think, of hitting some key pieces and of areas of thought, and maybe hopefully spark some reason to, if nothing else, tell people where documents are. Step one. Yeah.
Step Otherwise, two, let's have a conversation.
Says Colin. Says Colin.
Yeah. Oh no, it's a fact. You are demonstrably a bad person if you don't do that. No, this is the whole point of, like, virtually all of our podcasting is to provide some food for thought and cause you to ask questions and make you better prepared to sit down and talk to a professional. Like, if you listen to this and it cues some thoughts in your head and starts to organize your thoughts, that's going to make you better prepared to walk in and talk to your lawyer or your accountant or your financial advisor about these issues. That's our goal. Like, this is not a do-it-yourself, listen to this and you're all fine. This is just designed to better prepare you to have a conversation with a professional who is qualified to take a look at the whole playing field and say, in your situation, this is the kind of things that apply.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I find, start the conversation wherever you're comfortable. I find, you know, for those that are maybe uncomfortable having the conversation, let's say with a lawyer, or aren't fully decided, we can serve a good sort of starting point to say, well, let's start the conversation here about what your wishes might be, and put together a, you know, have that estate planning discussion, you know, beginnings here, and then let's take it to the lawyer from there, whether we attend with you or you go on your own. You maybe feel a bit more prepared and a bit more, you know, you've thought things through to an extent more than you had versus going in and let's make it happen.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, because there's a whole bunch of decisions. I mean, you know, estate planning obviously is a very personal thing, and, you know, a guided conversation with all the involved parties, which is, again, the topic of the podcast is, you know, having that conversation with the various stakeholders, if you want to put a business term on it, to the extent that that's possible or doable or desirable, you know, and there's situations where it happens with part of the family and not the other part. But this is worth considering how much of this you can do, because if you can get comfortable with and execute on this, it does make the world a better place.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say part of the family, not the other part. We didn't even touch on blended families. That's a whole another episode, maybe planning there. Yeah, this certainly adds in some complexities.
this is not a university lecture. This is a podcast. And again, if you have a blended family, there's a whole other chapter that, that we would get into.
Right. That's 201. This is 101 here.
There you go. Yeah.
There.
So you think we beat this one to death, Matt?
I think we have. Until next time.
Thanks, everybody. Like, follow, and pass this on to your friends. Looking forward to have you listen to us when the next one comes out. Thanks.
Thank you.
If you're breaking a sweat trying to figure out what your financial advisor is talking about, you're not getting the service you need. You probably hate trying to get an answer from them, but you also think moving your accounts will be a headache. And it might be. But working with don'trocktheboatwealthplanning.com or .ru isn't exactly stress-free, is it? Call us. We will demystify the world for you.
Please note, the information provided in this podcast is for general information purposes only. It is not intended as financial, investment, legal, tax, accounting, or other professional advice. Our discussions are not a solicitation to buy or sell any securities or to make any specific investments. Any decisions based on information contained in this podcast are the sole responsibility of the listener. We strongly advise consulting with a professional financial advisor before making any financial decisions. Listeners should be aware that investing involves risks and that past performance is not indicative of future results. Bare Naked Money is produced by Varican Capital Management, Inc., a licensed portfolio management company in Canada. We operate under the regulatory framework established by the provincial securities commissions in the provinces within which we operate. The views expressed in the podcast are our own and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of any regulatory authority. Remember, at Varican Capital Management, Inc., we focus on aligning our goals with yours, prioritizing integrity and transparency. For more information about us and our services, please visit our website. Thank you for listening, and let's continue to challenge the norms of the financial services industry together.